This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for the week ending 24 June 2016 for Expressions of Peace, Personal, Powerful, and Heart-to-Heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace radio tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur moves from our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels to a place of acceptance of the natural consequences of those actions. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur evolved from the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio, which was conceived as a project of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. While Sequitur continues to report on the human response to extreme weather events and advances in climate research, it has expanded to include the whole web of life. Aho, mitakwe oasin, we are all related. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. The Wall Street Journal reports a surge in natural gas prices in response to the record heat affecting much of the U.S. Especially in the Southwest, temperatures are resembling India's May experience, but the cubic yards of air-conditioned space per capita in the privileged U.S. culture is far in excess of that of India. While outdoor cultural and sporting events are taking a beating, the movie industry is having a boom time as people seek the air-conditioned comfort that's included in the price of a ticket. The Washington Post reports record-breaking heat for the date in much of the Southwest U.S. on Monday's co-occurrence of the full moon and the summer solstice, with high temperatures in the California towns of Needles and Blythe both exceeding 50 C. While Phoenix, Arizona wasn't quite that hot, the nighttime low temperature of 32.2 C set the all-time record for the earliest date with a low temperature that high. Daytime highs set records for the date in Las Vegas, Nevada, Tucson, Arizona, and Death Valley, California, as well as Phoenix. 100 degrees is another iconic Fahrenheit temperature which was surpassed in much of the region by 7 a.m. That's 37.8 C. Speaking of India, the New York Times wrap-up on the drought in Maharashtra makes hard reading for water-rich Westerners, especially in the wake of the flooding we've seen recently, and especially with relief on the way or recently arrived with the monsoon. Quote, "This year's drought is extreme, but severe weather is a regular occurrence in India. The authorities had time to plan." Unquote. A third of the population has been affected by the drought, with rural Indians abandoning their land and succumbing to corruption and extortion of what little remains to them, even as urban Indians enjoy unprecedented prosperity due to the influx of this desperate, unskilled labor force. For example, in previous years, it cost 2.5 days of a migrant's daily wages to pay rent on a 40-square-foot squat in a shanty town. But this year, they're expected to be grateful to live rent-free in such circumstances. Say what? A member of the state parliament paid a visit to one such settlement and distributed cash and grain, then took a YouTube video to depict the squatters as well-provisioned and content. The revenue minister paid a visit by helicopter, even though the area is accessible by train, and despite a special helipad being required with a water footprint for its construction of 10,000 liters. The next day, the water conservation minister paid a visit and tweeted selfies of her grinning face, with a parched riverbed in the background. 39 people have been killed and 13 are still missing as of Wednesday as stormy weather persists in Indonesia, reports the Jakarta Post. More than half a meter of floodwater rushed down roadways, washed out bridges, and inundated thousands of homes last Thursday night, forcing evacuations and triggering at least 3 landslides. Accumulated floodwater was up to 2 meters deep. The international airport saw 38 centimeters of rain in 12 hours and was forced to shut down for 7 hours when visibility was reduced to 250 meters for 5 hours. Safety regulations require 900 meters of visibility to operate. The Meteorology, Climatology, and Geophysics Agency did not hesitate to attribute the extreme weather across the region to climate change. Quote, the heavy precipitation is caused by the warmer-than-usual surface temperatures across Indonesia's western oceans. The hot and humid air current met the colder low-pressure front that originated from the Indian Ocean and caused climatic instability, close quote. That diabolical trio of high temperature, low humidity, and a steady breeze has four major fires affecting some 70,000 acres in three southwestern U.S. states, reports the Weather Channel. The first and biggest is the North Fire in New Mexico, which has been burning for nearly a month and is only 30% contained. The Doghead Fire tripled in size last week. This fire is southeast of Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the last rainfall was measured on 1 June at just 3 millimeters. AccuWeather reports the Doghead Fire only 9% contained as of Monday. The Cedar Fire is newer. It just started last Wednesday and was at 10,000 acres by the end of the week. It more than doubled in size over the weekend, reports KJZZ. Also started last Wednesday, the potentially most explosive of the four is the Sherpa Fire. By virtue of its proximity to an ExxonMobil facility and atmospheric conditions that are incubating fire NATOs as it rushes toward the ocean. Led by heavy equipment, including a DC-10 jumbo jet, a literal army has been deployed to try to chase it back up into the mountains, but it was only 6% contained as of last Friday. Near Los Angeles in the San Gabriel Mountains, two other smaller fires torched 4,500 acres, reports the Washington Post. According to the San Gabriel Valley Tribune, the reservoir fire was started by a car that plunged off the highway, killing one person. The cause of the other fire, called the Fish Fire, is unknown. Hundreds of homes were evacuated. But it's fireworks season as well, and the sheeple do enjoy the warlike sounds of explosions. In the state of Washington, the city of Centralia has a new section in its municipal code that, quote, would allow for an emergency ban on the discharge of fireworks under extreme weather conditions with a 45-day notice, unquote. Say what? Do emergencies give 45 days notice? How far in advance are extreme weather conditions declared? Let's talk about safety. Four hikers are dead and one is missing in the southwestern U.S. in separate incidents unrelated to the fires. Two hikers were stranded by extreme weather in the state of Washington on Mount Rainier but successfully rescued, reports the Olympian. This is recreation? Rescue efforts at the South Pole are more complex and expensive than such a mission to the space station would be. Even the specially designed Twin Otter aircraft must make the trip to the Amundsen Scott Research Base in stages, stopping at Punta Arenas, Chile, and then at the Antarctic Research Station at Rothera, reports Inverse. No amount of clever engineering can keep the fuel from freezing or the planes from being grounded when their skis stick to the ice. The current company of some 50 research and support staff are employees of Lockheed Martin and the National Science Foundation. The rarely contemplated rescue mission was successfully completed for the first time in 2001 when the company doctor got pancreatitis. This is employment? Is the hardship pay worth the risk? Is the data they return worth the hardship pay? Planes can't fly in extremely hot weather either, as dismayed vacationers and business people with a Phoenix, Arizona destination discovered this week. Global mean temperature may only be up by 1.5°C, but it's twice that high inland, up to 5 times that high in the heat islands of our cities, and up to 10 times that high on an asphalt runway. Trains are also affected as tracks buckle and increase the risk of derailment. No amount of replacing combustion engines with electric ones can change the devastating loss of community due to addiction to the on-demand vehicular mobility that sustains car culture and the wage slavery it enables. When pavement compromised by a winter freeze-thaw cycle is subjected to increasing rainfall and rapid temperature spikes, the result is dangerous buckling pavement, explains AccuWeather. The physical cause is thermal expansion, the same process that causes sea level rise in excess of amounts attributable to melting glaciers and ice sheets. The first few incidents were merely amusing, but in this week of record-breaking heat waves across the North American Great Plains, dozens to more than 100 incidents have been reported in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Colorado. This novel highway hazard is an interesting escalation of the more traditional urban pothole problem, since these major wrinkles tend to span roadways, especially at seams in the concrete. Blacktop is more flexible but also generates more toxic emissions and greenhouse gases in extreme heat. Potholes and buckling are in turn distinct from subsidence and sinkholes, such as we saw a few months ago under the pavement in downtown New Orleans. Repairs are at taxpayer expense. Florida continues to build on its coast in defiance of sea level rise. Scientific American refers to the gentrification of adaptation to climate change as the wealthy build multi-million dollar supposedly stormproof and floodproof homes, and then expect the taxpayer to follow suit with services, infrastructure, and disaster relief when the sea rises sooner than expected, or when uncontrolled variables and therefore uninsured threats, such as erosion and subsidence, exert their effect. A study released last month by the Urban Land Institute urged government officials to consider buying out people whose homes have flooded multiple times over the years, many of whom are low-income renters or homeowners, and return the land to its original purpose as a floodplain. But floodplains don't pay taxes, and nobody makes a profit from reducing risk. An estimated 11,000 condominium units are under construction in more than 100 buildings in three South Florida counties. But Florida is not the only one unwilling to address the real culprit, which is overdevelopment and urbanization driven by capitalism and exponential population growth. In a recent study covered in the Michigan State University Extension, their Department of Health and Human Services Division of Environmental Health lists six public health impacts due to climate change that are anticipated in this northern inland state. 1. Respiratory diseases from increased air pollution, a longer growing season, increased pollen levels, and air mass stagnation. 2. Heat-related illnesses from higher temperatures combined with urban heat island effects. 3. Waterborne diseases from failure of overburdened sewer systems. 4. Vector-borne diseases such as West Nile virus and Lyme disease due to more favorable conditions for ticks with warmer winters and earlier springs. 5. Traumatic injuries from freezing rain and flooding. 6. Carbon monoxide poisoning from more frequent use of diesel-powered generators and kerosene or propane heaters during the inevitable power outages due to extreme weather events. The paper places the onus of responsibility for land use regulation squarely on local governments and says that, quote, adaptation strategies include enlarging storm drains and culverts, upgrading wastewater facilities, increasing building setbacks in flood-prone or storm-impacted areas, and protecting and installing green infrastructure in urban areas to mitigate stormwater and reduce heat island effects, unquote. This sounds like a sterling example of the gentrification of adaptation to climate change the Scientific American article was talking about in Florida. 19 people were killed and 600 kilometers of the Rio Doce destroyed in the worst mining accident in Brazil's history when the Fundão Dam collapsed on 5 November 2015, reports Al Jazeera. 13 were workers at the site of the collapse. Two of the world's biggest mining corporations, Vale S.A. and BHP Billiton, jointly owned Samarco, the operator of the dam. The company had been warned about the dam several times and advised to increase monitoring of it and to reinforce it with a buttress, but Samarco did not follow the recommendations. In fact, they did not forward an evacuation order or any sort of alarm to the 200 villagers downstream, where live thousands of people. Fishermen lost their livelihoods, farmers lost their irrigation source and livestock, the drinking water of millions of people was contaminated, and more than 900 hectares of cropland soil was covered in toxic sludge. It took 16 days for the 62 million cubic meters of toxic mining waste to reach the ocean. Samarco reassured the residents that the waste floating down the river did not constitute any danger to humans, but a later analysis registered arsenic, manganese, and other poisonous substances. To reinforce the mixed message, the company distributed brochures claiming that the water was safe to drink, but made daily deliveries with not only bottled drinking water, but also water for livestock and for washing. As of February, some 14 corporate decision makers were under investigation for crimes against the environment, but they settled out of court for $5.6 billion. Tropical Storm Danielle is the earliest fourth named storm in the Atlantic, according to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. A very short lived storm due to the brevity of its incubation over water, it brought floods and landslides to the east coast of Mexico. A brief scan of the headlines reveals that heavy rain, stormy winds, and damaging hail have been sweeping Europe and Australia this week. A 2-year-old was killed when a tree fell on the car in which she was riding, reports the Romania Journal. Another person was killed and a third is missing in severe storms in the north and central part of Romania, while the south is under severe heat warnings. According to a new study in Nature Geoscience, the mountain forests of the Bavarian Alps have seen a 14% reduction in humus in their topsoil over the past 3 decades, reports Science Daily. In contrast, adjoining pasture lands show no such decline, possibly because most of the surface humus layer was lost when the trees were originally cleared. A healthy humus layer is essential to the health of the forest, and a healthy forest, besides sequestering carbon, can store water against periods of drought and slow the rush of floodwaters during periods of heavy rain. Writing for Standard Digital, George Mbakaya listed a number of adaptation strategies for Kenyan farmers as the abrupt termination of the long-awaited rains threatened crops, livestock, and the health of the land itself. He wrote that Climate Smart Agriculture, the program discussed on last week's Sequitur, is, quote, reorienting agricultural policies and practices in response to climate change, unquote. Most of the country had no rain at all from January to April, the usual rainy season, while instead frost and hail visited some areas. My cultural enhancement this week is an essay I wrote 3 months ago at the Vernal Equinox. I had an unwitting co-author in the person of Leanne Fulkerson, who wrote the first draft as her self-introduction to the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. I found it so heartfelt, soulful, and eloquent that I replaced her personal details with my own and posted it as a note on my timeline with the title Doom Without Gloom, and I'm tweaking a few details today to prepare it for this medium. But before I read the essay and wrap up this edition of Sequitur, I'm happy to present a very special guest interview by the founder of the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group, Mike Farragan, with paleoclimatologist Paul Beckwith.
I'm extremely pleased that Susan Livingston has invited me to have a little interview with Paul Beckwith, who is walking down the street in Ottawa. Are you Paul?
Yes, that's correct.
And as you'll know from a lot of Paul's videos, Paul tends to walk down the street and does some quite entertaining videos and walking down the street. So I believe he's got a whole new series coming up soon to look out for as well. Do you just want to tell us who you are, Paul?
Yes, I study abrupt climate change with the University of Ottawa Laboratory for Paleoclimatology. So I have a engineering physics background, and also I've worked a lot in laser physics in the past, and I've been studying climate change for quite a few years.
I would say, from my experience, Paul Beckwith is the person that I would go to if I wanted to know anything about climate change or systems or the holistic picture on the planet regarding the interaction of all the different systems, be it atmospheric, be it ocean, earth systems. Paul usually has the answer on it. Really, why I'm interviewing Paul here is that me and Susan were talking about a couple of things, and a couple of things which confuse me and confuse quite a lot of people probably, and we're hoping that Paul will be able to help us answer these questions. So we'll just bash on, Paul.
Sure.
And the first question is not a simple question, but are we in a runaway climate change at the moment?
Most scientists would not use the term runaway to describe climate change that's occurring at the moment. Terms like very rapid climate change, abrupt climate change, nonlinear climate change, things like that, much faster than expected, you know, is a favorite term that scientists use all the time. They have been for years when they describe climate change. But runaway would imply that the system basically turns in, you know, the Earth turns into a Venus type thing, and people don't think that in the science community.
Right.
That would happen.
Right. On that subject, then, that I think some people are quite confused that they think that the methane clathrate gun has fired, and that means that we're in runaway climate change.
Well, when you talk about abrupt climate change and nonlinear climate change, you basically go from one state where you get linear change to another state, a different state where you also have linear change, but it's completely different from the first state. For example, the climate that we're used to having would be, you know, the state we're leaving, and we could be going to a climate where it's, say, 5 degrees Celsius warmer, you know, on average, global average temperature, you know, a state with eventually with no sea ice in the Arctic, no snow cover, completely uniform temperature in the Northern Hemisphere with latitude, or almost completely uniform, you know, quite a different world.
So you go from one linear state to another stable linear state.
Yeah, and the transition that you change from one state to another is a sort of a period of abrupt climate change. And, you know, it's very likely, I think, that we're undergoing that type of thing right now.
Right.
We have been for a number of years.
Right. And on that subject, did you think there's any likelihood of a blue ocean event this year?
I think the probability of a blue ocean event happening is very high. The ice is disappearing via a number of mechanisms. Most people think of a very warm air temperature, melting the ice, getting melt pools on the top, making it darker, absorbing more sunlight, increasing the melt rate. Also, the seawater underneath is above zero, so it's melting the ice from underneath. And also, a very big factor in the Arctic is export of ice through the Fram Strait. And that very much depends on the Beaufort Gyre, what's called the Beaufort Gyre wind pattern, transpolar drift. So it depends on the weather in the Arctic, the wind patterns, which then generate movement of ocean currents and ice movement. And then you get export of large amounts of ice out the Fram Strait between Greenland and Svalbard. And then that ice goes into the Atlantic and it melts very quickly. So if there's a lot of export out the Fram Strait in the next few months, we could very well see a blue ocean event where there's less than a million square kilometers of ice left.
Right, Paul. And just quickly to say that for those who don't understand this, a blue ocean event is where the Arctic doesn't have any ice. Is that right?
It's basically an ice-free Arctic.
An ice-free Arctic.
So we lose our highly reflective white shield at the North Pole. You know, the ice is highly reflective, reflects a lot of sunlight, keeps it cool, and we lose the ice. You know, we would lose it for a couple weeks or a month when the first so-called blue ocean event happened. The white ice is replaced by dark ocean underneath, which then absorbs a lot more solar radiation.
Yeah, just one of many feedback loops.
So what this will do is this will increase the likelihood that methane will come up. It will greatly increase the melt rate from Greenland because the whole Arctic will be warmer. And it will basically fracture and destroy the jet streams, which depend on the temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator. So weather patterns, if you think they're bad now, you haven't seen anything yet. The extreme weather events are going to increase in frequency, severity, and duration significant amounts once we have an ice-free Arctic.
Yeah, not really looking forward to that one, Paul. And I know a lot of people are suffering at the moment and have been suffering for decades from extreme weather. And we're quite privileged in a way that we remain untouched. But I believe recently you had the occasion to visit somebody's house, which had been destroyed by climate change. Is that right?
Well, that's a difficult thing to pin on. Like the atmosphere is unstable. There's a lot more energy in the atmosphere. We get more intense storms. What you're referring to is a trip I made to Kansas to Tornado Alley. Yeah. And I saw the destruction that an EF4 tornado had made as it tracked 26 miles along the ground, about a half a mile wide.
Oh, right.
And so this was a tornado. And, you know, tornadoes are, there should be more intense tornadoes probably as a result of a, you know, it depends. But there's a lot of factors that go into tornadoes, like wind shear, the energy in the atmosphere, the amount of moisture, a lot of different factors. And what's not clear is that, I mean, in the short term, during the transition, the abrupt transition, you can have more wind shear. But then once you've equalized the temperature between the Arctic and the equator, you would expect maybe the wind patterns to decrease in amplitude. You know, that would be once you've reached this state that we're heading to.
Right. Just a couple of things on the subject before we move on that I'd like clarity on. Is there any likelihood of this 50 gigaton burp of methane, do you think?
Well, there's about 5 gigatons of methane in the atmosphere right now. That's sort of the concentration. That gives about 1850 parts per billion. So, you know, if we just had a 10 gigaton release, that would pretty much double the methane level in the atmosphere. So Peter Wadhams modeled a 50 gigatons release over a few years or over 10 years, both situations, and estimated that the economic cost would be about $70 trillion, something ridiculously high. So yes, methane coming up is a huge risk, and it would greatly increase the rate of change that we would experience in terms of temperature and everything else. So I think we'd have trouble growing food. We'd have food shortages, global food shortages that would be extremely severe around the planet if we had such an event happen.
Right. So, but regardless of that, methane is erupting from Siberia and the Arctic as we speak, even on a kind of linear scale. You know, what kind of temperature increase do you envisage over what kind of time period?
Well, if you go by the paleo records, we've easily had temperature increases of 5 or 6 degrees in a decade or two. So I think that's the sort of numbers that we'll see if we lose Arctic sea ice completely and if methane then starts to, you know, coming out of the terrestrial permafrost, which thaws, and the ocean sediments, especially on the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf,
right,
which the Russians have documented.
And that's not including one big burp. That's just a linear increase, yeah?
Yeah, well, I mean, a big burp, you know, if you're looking on a geological time scale, you know, a release of methane over decades or, you know, 100 years seems a big burp, you know, on longer-term records. So
yeah,
in terms of, you know, what was the fastest rate that it came out at? I mean, Wadhams actually looked at one big burp or, you know, something like 5 gigatons a year for 10 years.
Yeah.
And he found similar problems to society from both scenarios.
Okay, that's great, Paul. Thanks for that. The other thing was, while we're on that kind of area of the world, was what's your latest take on the, it seems that the North Atlantic blob is not so cold anymore. So what is your take on the present state of the Gulf Stream?
Well, yes, the blob that you're referring to south of Greenland, fairly extensive feature, you know, in the sea surface temperature in the last few years, is thought to have been mostly a result of meltwater from Greenland moving southward. Also, if the Gulf Stream is no longer moving there and is moving further south, you'd expect where the new location where it was moving to be warmer and the where it used to be now colder. So there's a bit of that going on, too. And the size does fluctuate. We've had a strong El Nino, which has warmed the waters of the Pacific greatly and brought lots of water over North America, you know, in rainfall and so on. It's disrupted patterns around the world, and it's kind of tapered off. And now the question is, will we go to the opposite, the La Nina? You know, that's still an open question.
Yeah.
But there's definitely the Arctic temperature amplification is meaning that the temperature difference to the equator is smaller. So there's less heat transported from the equator up there. 2/3 of that heat goes via the atmosphere. 1/3 goes via the oceans. And we know the jet streams have been completely disrupted. And it only makes sense that the ocean currents are being completely disrupted with a longer lag time.
Yeah.
Because things generally take longer. Ocean currents move a lot slower than air currents, say, in the jet stream.
Right. So if you were to go back a year or 2 years, do you think the Gulf Stream is in a similar or a worse situation in terms of its altering?
Well, the Gulf Stream is definitely changing character. In 2010, 2011, the hot water from the Gulf Stream was overriding the continental shelves off the eastern U.S. more than it would normally do, and that caused a sea level rise of something like 125 millimeters in 1 year, you know, a glitch, sort of a rise. And that's because the water is warmer. Warmer water expands, also because the water is being pushed up to the coast. And sensors at 26.5 degrees, which sort of run down from the surface to the bottom of the ocean, measured it. If you believe those sensors, the Gulf Stream basically stopped for a period of time and then restarted, you know, at that time period.
Right, well, I'm possibly particularly worried about this living in Scotland, Paul.
Yes, most people have seen that movie, Gulf Stream Shuts Off. You know, no heat's transferred over to Europe. Europe goes into a deep freeze, but I think that the greenhouse gases will prevent, you know, there'll be some cooling, but I don't think it'll be as severe
right.
as anybody thinks, because greenhouse gases are elevated and, you know, there will be regional changes from the ocean currents switching. Mm. You know, but shutting off, I mean, they're not going to do it overnight. I can see them doing it over a few years, perhaps, or like I say, it's all, you know, the time scales are difficult because, you know, if something takes 100 years, that's like overnight if you're measuring the geological time
yeah.
scale, right? And so it shows, you know, an abrupt change on the geological time scale could take, you know, a decade or two on human time scales.
Right, so right? I've still got time to buy in some woolies, yeah, some woolly socks and thick jackets and things, just in case.
Yes, and, you know, this is all assuming that humans play dumb and don't do anything, right?
Yeah.
You know, we continue changing the chemistry of the atmosphere and oceans with our emissions. You know, we don't try to prevent some of these things happening.
Right, Paul. I think we'll have ample time to talk about that subject. It brings me nicely onto the second question I was going to ask you. It's about CO2 emissions. At the moment, they're obviously they seem to be higher in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere, because that's where they all get let off. But what I'd like to ask you, is there any evidence at all that the industrial society in 2016 is actually decreasing its emissions?
Well, if we look at the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere, the concentrations, they typically rose about 1.5 parts per million in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and then they accelerated in the last decade to about 2.5 parts per million. And then in 2015, they were over 3. It was the rise was over 3 parts per million. So this is very concerning, especially given that the International Energy Agency and other bodies have said that human emissions have flattened out, because the levels in the atmosphere certainly haven't flattened out. So this leads to the question, you know, have we reduced the capacity of the sinks, like the ocean? The ocean's warmer, especially this year because of the El Nino, so therefore it absorbs less CO2. Warmer water cannot hold as much dissolved gases. The thing that really matters is the CO2 in the atmosphere, and then there's an exchange with the ocean. So the levels of the atmosphere and oceans are what really matters. The origin of it, the climate doesn't care. You know, if it's there, it's going to cause, you know, rapid climate change.
Right. And also, just to finish off, Paul, this idea which confuses a lot of people, which is either 40, 30, 20 or 10, and seems to be changed at a whim of a particular scientist or group of scientists, about the time lag of CO2 emissions. Can you say something about that?
Yes. A lot of the heat goes into the ocean from climate change, in fact, 90-95% of the heat. And this heat then is released slowly to the atmosphere, and it can take about 20 years to reach equilibrium. So we've got excess heat in the ocean, so that's going to be relayed into warming, even if we completely stopped emissions, unless we devise ways to remove that excess heat from the system.
I'm probably a lot of people are kind of thinking of this wrongly. I've been kind of thinking of it in terms of, well, there's been, in 2006, we let off so much carbon dioxide. And in 2016, that carbon dioxide is going to hit into the atmosphere and take effect. Is that a completely wrong way to look at this?
Well, the CO2 level, of course, is tied to the temperature, right? So, you know, it's the CO2 level, the temperature, and as I said, most of the heating goes into the ocean. So the lag is really dependent on how long it takes that heat to, you know, if it goes into the oceans and goes under the surface, how long does it take for that water to reappear at the surface to heat the atmosphere, right? And the ocean current times can be fairly long. So it gives you this lag. I mean, I like to, there's lags in the system. I mean, think of the sun is the hottest at the zenith, which is at noon, but the maximum daily temperature only occurs, 3-4 o'clock or something like that, which is 3 or 4 hours after the sun intensity has been maximum. Mm. And that's because there's a lag.
Yeah.
So similar in the oceans, only the lag is longer.
Yeah, and there's also obviously a lot of interrelating factors which, are uncertain, which make my statement that, 2006 is going to occur in 2016 in terms of emissions a bit silly, really, because there's lots of interacting factors we don't really know about, yeah?
Yes, I mean, the actual, if you put CO2 in a bell jar and shine a light bulb through it, you get absorption of the light. You know, if you increase the CO2 concentration, you instantly get a lot more absorption of the light. So on a molecular basis, that's what's happening. But where the heat is stored is dependent on the oceans and the atmosphere and the interactions.
Right. Are you anywhere near your destination yet, Paul?
I'm about 5 minutes away. Two of my kids play badminton, and I have to pick them up where they're playing badminton, and then they have piano lessons. So.
Yeah, that's all good stuff. It keeps us distracted from this doom and gloom, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so it's,
one tends to compartmentalize, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're, spending a lot of time studying the climate system, as I obviously do. You have to sort of compartmentalize it.
Yeah, you have to do it, otherwise you go bloody mad, Paul.
Yes, that's, I would refer to an Esquire article by Jason Box, where he talks about, what he studies, glacier melt on Greenland and how he deals with that on a day-to-day basis.
Then how does he deal with it?
Well, it's the same sort of thing. I mean, you have this, you feel that you have a moral obligation to get your information out to the public.
Yeah, for sure.
A lot more quickly than, say, just going through the peer review process.
Yeah.
Like, you want to do that anyway, but, to get your grants, et cetera, as a scientist, but, you don't want the information to be buried and come out, years later.
Yeah.
Climate system is changing too quickly for that.
So, I mean, your reputation must be skyrocketing.
I don't know. I'm becoming famous or infamous. I'm not sure which. Depends on your point of view, I guess.
Well, in terms of all your predictions coming true.
Yes. Well, I had to laugh today because there's a big conference and a big bunch of politicians and stuff are talking about climate change, and there was a big talk on the Arctic sea ice, and a big quote, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It's not like Las Vegas. And every time I hear that statement, I think, I really should have trademarked that when I thought of it during the television interview about 4 or 5 years ago. That's okay. It doesn't matter.
So you've got a new series of videos coming up soon, yeah?
Yes, I'm intending on doing some videos on global dimming, on why we're in the state we are, why it's taken so long to do anything, so some of the psychology behind that. Also, I haven't done anything on methane for a while, so I need to do a big update video on what's going on with methane, perhaps another one on the heat waves in India and the U.S. There's always lots of topics. You never run out of topics.
Well, you're more than welcome. On. More than welcome, as you know, Paul, to stick him up on the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group. At that juncture, Paul arrived very abruptly at his destination and was cut off. So I'd just like to thank Paul very much for the interview and thank Susan Livingston for inviting me and Paul onto Sequitur.
Thank you, Paul Beckwith, for your work. And thank you, Mike Farragan, for your continuing collaboration. And now, doom without gloom. I am regularly overwhelmed by layers of emotion, both powerful and subtly nuanced. Mostly, at the moment, I am completely astounded that I could witness the end of human civilization and the concurrent end of all or most of life on Earth. What I thought I wanted only yesterday pales in comparison to what I find that I really want today. My dear ones close to me, my relationships harmonious, my heart full of love and joy. The things that used to cause me grief and anxious sleepless nights are suddenly quite trivial. It makes me wonder if those things were ever really important at all. Bank accounts, careers, houses, future plans. Some of the climate scientists are trying to temper their alarm by using politically correct terms, or even by withholding their findings because those findings are anathema to their funders, or because they have no solutions to offer. However, others are using words like explosive, astounding, significant, emergency. One would think that society would hear their words, see their data, and realize that things are imminently, devastatingly serious. One would think that globally nations and peoples would want to come together and make peace in the face of the enormity of a planetary disaster unlike anything in Earth's previous history. Sadly, civilization is not so civil, and many of those who get it become rabid proselytizers and use their knowledge as a bludgeon, a bomb rather than a bomb. There will be no turning off the engine. It will run until it runs out of fuel or encounters or engenders something cataclysmic enough to shut it down. All the fools will go down with the ship. There's nowhere else to go. Every day I awaken anew to the realization that I am living among the last human beings to experience this planet. This insight is so mind-boggling that I have no idea how to hold it. I want to put everything aside and travel to all the places that will soon be gone. I want to hunker down with the provisions that may help soften my landing. I want to seek community and companionship to cope with the loss, grief, and sheer insanity. I want to walk into the landscape naked and alone until I can walk no farther and burn up, bleed out, desiccate, or drown along with all my relations. I want to live wholly, and I want to die quickly. It turns out that our species is not immune to math. Our population growth has turned the exponential corner. Our resource needs exceed the carrying capacity of our habitat. The sixth great extinction is underway. Scary as it may be to face, I find acceptance in the realization that extinction is not a punishment to avert by following the rules or trying harder. Rather, extinction is necessary to evolution, in much the same way as death is necessary to life. My latest, greatest, most painful insight is that expecting the process of evolution to freeze at Homo sapiens sapiens is the height of hubris. So I sit with my heart breaking for this beautiful planet and its amazing ability to support life in a cold, chaotic, and indifferent universe. In this narrow slice of space on this tiny blue dot that hangs at a precise distance, the Goldilocks zone, between scorching and freezing, I have experienced life in just one of its millions of forms. I am unique, the only me in the known universe. Yet I am inconsequential and powerless to stop or change the effects of the civilization into which I was born that contained the seeds of its own demise from its inception, just as my living body contained the seeds of its own death from its conception. I am here now and relatively blissful in my bubble. My story is but a character, a punctuation mark in the cosmic story, the next chapter of which is written in the methane, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and water vapor that is changing the composition of our Earth's atmosphere beyond the parameters that have so generously sustained life as I understand it. I am breathing, but barely, as the oxygen-giving oceanic plankton and trees of the rainforest succumb to habitat collapse, and as my internal respiratory processes succumb to congenital defects activated by an increasingly toxic environment. In parting, I would say to life in all its forms, I love you, and may peace be upon you. According to Stanford University's Political Psychology Research Group led by John Krosnick, the social science survey researchers have been asking the wrong questions. In a new study released last week by the Metcalf Institute and reported in the Huffington Post, 74% of Americans said they believe that global warming will be a serious problem for the U.S., and 83% said they believe that global warming will be a serious problem for the world. Only 9% of Americans are sure that global warming has not been happening. And when asked if the U.S. government should limit emissions by American companies, 78% say yes. Krosnick quips, quote, "You never get three-quarters of Americans agreeing on anything," unquote. Alexander Verbeek, founder of the Planetary Security Initiative, predicts that social conversations will soon be about the moment you realize that you were witnessing climate change for the first time. Quote, "It will be the where were you question of the next decade," unquote. When I first read this article, it was like balm for my tortured, ugly American soul. But I became skeptical on further contemplation of the fact that when the Gallup poll asks what is the most important problem facing this country today, as they have asked every year since 1930, climate change and environment ranks last every time, beneath jobs, healthcare, education, security, infrastructure, terrorism, kids, housing, transportation. Nor am I reassured by the leap to first place when the question is framed in the future tense. What will be the most important problem facing the world in the future if nothing is done to address it? To which 25% of Americans answered climate change or environment, more than twice as many as the next two runners-up, terrorism and unemployment in the economy, while each of those two scored twice as high as the next four runners-up, government and politics, health care, war and peace, and overpopulation, which were tied at 5% with those who declined to answer. So all other answers fade by comparison. Balm for my soul? On further contemplation, what these data tell me is that my culture is willing to abdicate responsibility to future generations for addressing the most serious threat to the survival of our species we've ever encountered. In his address in observance of the World Day to Combat Desertification, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said that some 50% of our agricultural land is moderately to severely degraded by unsustainable farming, mining, overgrazing, clear-cutting, and climate change, but he uttered not a word about urbanization and population growth. He added, quote, "Over the next 25 years, land degradation could reduce global food productivity by as much as 12%, leading to a 30% increase in world food prices," unquote. In an attempt to provide breeding grounds for marine life and storm protection for coastal regions, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is seeking grant proposals for projects requesting between $100,000 and $2 million designed to restore wetland and barrier reef habitats, reports the St. Thomas Source. The construction and tourism industries will not be pleased. The application deadline is 16 August. More information can be found at grants.gov or from the NOAA's Office of Habitat Conservation. Writing for Consortium News, author Jonathan Marshall explains the geopolitical situation in the Middle East, where withdrawing access to water is a military strategy far more effective than the interventions being deployed in the region by the U.S. military. He relates not only the current civil upheaval and refugee crisis to climate change, but also the conception and incubation of the Arab Spring and other civil unrest going back to the second half of the last decade, and concludes that, quote, "Sending more anti-tank rockets to insurgent rebels and bombing a continuously shifting array of opponents from Iraq to Yemen is unlikely to provide lasting solutions for the region. Washington should instead be providing technical assistance, aid to strengthen critical infrastructure, and encouragement for regional collaboration," unquote. Preach it, brother! Thanks for following Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, archived at panina.org. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. We'll be right back.
to see it and now you don't. Going through walls and floors, through the ages and out of time. It's only matter, it's no matter at all. It created this in its travels, coming through. What connects us is one.